Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, everyone. So today we're doing a deep dive into S.A. Cosby's novel, Razorblade Tears. It came out in 2021, critically acclaimed.
And for good reason. It's more than just a crime novel, isn't it?
Absolutely. It fits into that Southern noir or rural noir category. Cosby is just brilliant at weaving these, you know, high-stakes thriller plots with some really deep social commentary.
Yeah, he tackles race, class, and especially toxic masculinity head-on.
Right. And this book, Razorblade Tears, it starts with this just devastating tragedy. It forces two fathers who are complete opposites to team up.
Polar opposites, one black, one white.
And they're seeking vengeance after their married gay sons, Isaiah and Derek, are murdered.
It's brutal, but the core here, the real journey, isn't just the violence. It's about atonement, isn't it?
Exactly. It's this painful, almost backward journey to make up for how they failed their sons while they were alive. Their inability to fully accept them.
Mm-hmm. A reckoning.
Yeah. Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's start by really looking at these two fathers, Ike and Buddy Lee.
Right. The gap between them initially feels, well, huge. You got Ike Randolph first. He's black. He did time. An ex-con.
But he's built a life since then. Runs a successful landscaping business. Seems very controlled.
Stoic is the word, I think. Controlled fury simmering underneath. He's a man who seems to have locked down his past, his emotions, just to get by, carries it all inside.
And then there's Buddy Lee Jenkins, just the complete opposite.
Totally. Buddy Lee is white, a mechanic, drinks hard, also an ex-con. But unlike Ike, he hasn't really escaped his past or his prejudices, frankly.
Lives a much rougher kind of life.
Yeah, and his grief, his rage, it's not contained at all. It's like a wildfire, just burning everything. He doesn't suppress, he just explodes.
Wow. So you have controlled fury meets wildfire rage.
Pretty much. But then this tragedy hits. The murder of their sons, Isaiah and Derek. This loving, interracial gay couple.
And that loss just shatters both their worlds. It becomes the one thing they have in common.
Well, that and the guilt. The crushing guilt. Because both of them, in their own ways, failed to really, truly accept their son's relationship, their sexuality, their marriage.
They offered support, maybe money, a place to stay.
Yeah.
But the love wasn't unconditional.
No, it was conditional. And that conditionality, that lack of full acceptance, haunts them. It's like they were fathers in practical terms, but failed in the emotional core of it.
There's that line in the book that just nails it, right? Her man can love his son and still fail him every day of his life.
Mm, powerful stuff. They protected them from some things, maybe, but not from their own disapproval. And that failure is really the engine driving everything that follows.
So how does it kick off? The quest, I mean.
Well, the official channels fail them, which is crucial. The police investigation into the murders, It just sort of stalls out.
They don't seem to take it seriously.
It feels like that. Maybe treated as routine or maybe, you know, quietly dismissed because of who Isaiah and Derek were. Gay, interracial. It makes the police maybe less invested in digging deep. They want it closed.
So the system's indifference kind of mirrors the father's own past failures in a way.
Exactly. The system is writing them off just like Ike and Buddy Lee, maybe subconsciously, had written off a part of their son's identities.
So that frustration, that guilt, it boils over.
It does. They meet at the gravesite.
Yeah.
And it's tense, awkward, angry. They form this this really uneasy alliance.
Not exactly shaking hands and making a plan.
No. It's more like this shared, unspoken acknowledgement. They both know what needs to be done, the kind of violence they're capable of, and that the law isn't going to deliver the justice they need.
So the grief story turns into a revenge thriller.
But it's more than that. It's a quest for self-redemption wrapped in violence.
And how do they even start? They're not detectives.
Right, they're not. The book calls them aging instruments of blunt force, which I think is perfect. They operate on instinct, on skills learned in prison.
Contacts from the criminal underworld in rural Virginia.
Exactly. Their investigation method is basically violent coercion. They beat information out of people.
Sounds messy.
It is. And dangerous. They're navigating this really specific, often marginalized southern landscape. And as they follow the trail, it leads them into deeper and deeper trouble.
Towards who?
Eventually, it brings them into direct conflict with this white supremacist motorcycle gang, the Rare Breed.
Oh, wow. Okay, that sounds like a major escalation.
Huge. And that confrontation is incredibly violent, a massive, brutal fight.
And they have to fight together.
Side by side, literally covering each other's backs against this embodiment of pure hatred.
That must change things between them.
Profoundly. That fight strips away everything else. Their own prejudices, the racial tension, the class difference. None of it matters when you're fighting for your life against that kind of enemy.
They see each other just as fathers, grieving men.
Exactly. Fighting the same darkness. It's a truly horrific way to bond, but cements something between them.
But that bond gets tested pretty quickly, right?
Okay.
There's a big twist.
Yes. This is where the story really pivots. They find out Isaiah and Derek weren't just random victims of a hate crime.
No. Then what happened?
It's much uglier. In a different way. They were targeted. They had a video, apparently, that incriminated a local businessman, a very wealthy, powerful guy named Gerald.
Incriminated him for what?
Assaulting a young woman. The video was proof. So their son's murder. It wasn't about hate, not directly. It was a cold-blooded cover-up, silencing them to protect this powerful man.
Whoa, okay. That changes everything.
It really does.
So it's not just about homophobia anymore or even racism between them. It's about systemic corruption, power protecting itself.
Precisely. Their quest for vengeance suddenly has a much bigger target. It's not just about the killers. It's about the whole system that allowed this, that protects men like Gerald. It moves from personal bigotry, including their own internal struggles with it, to institutional rot.
And how does that affect Ike and Buddy Lee's relationship, this new information?
It deepens it, strangely enough. They're relying on each other completely now. That mutual suspicion and barely contained hostility the book talks about, it starts to genuinely dissolve.
They see the shared humanity underneath.
Yes, past the skin color, past the background. They're just two guys united by this immense grief and now this shared enemy. Buddy Lee even says it, something like, grief ain't got no color.
And it sure don't care about the color of your skin.
Yeah.
Powerful moment.
It really lands.
So that leads us nicely into the core themes, doesn't it?
Mm.
Let's talk about redemption. Atonement.
Right. Because this whole violent crusade, it's their last shot at being the fathers they should have been. It's like a really bloody form of penance.
They're trying to earn back something. Not forgiveness, maybe, but worthiness in the eyes of their son's memory.
I think so. It's about making things right on some cosmic scale because they failed so badly in life.
Yeah.
And it comes down to that brutal truth. You can't love somebody halfway. Either you love them or you don't. Their halfway love was basically a rejection.
And that ties into the whole theme of toxic masculinity.
Absolutely. Their failure stemmed from embodying that code. Be tough. Don't show emotion. Control everything. Right. Stoicism. Distance.
The only way they knew how to show care.
Yeah.
Maybe providing things. Or now. Through violence.
Right. And this journey just smashes that identity apart. They're physically broken down, which forces them to break down emotionally, too. They have to become vulnerable to survive and to truly mourn together.
Which brings us to the title itself, The Razor Blade Tears. We have to talk about that metaphor.
Oh, yeah. It's central. It's not just crying.
No, it's grief that's so deep, so painful, but also so shameful because of their conditioning.
That the tears themselves feel like they're cutting you. Physical pain from emotional suppression.
It perfectly captures that inability to mourn openly. Men like Ike and Buddy Lee in that world, they're allowed to rage, but not really to weep.
So the razor blade tears are that suppressed pain trying to force its way out. It's such a visceral image, says everything about their internal struggle.
And amid all this violence and pain, there's the theme of family and legacy, centered around the daughter, Ariana.
Yes, Isaiah and Derek's orphan daughter. She's the innocent outcome of the love they did share, the love the fathers couldn't fully embrace.
So she represents hope, a future.
A second chance, definitely. A chance for Ike and Buddy Lee to finally offer that unconditional love they withheld before. She becomes the reason, the legacy worth fighting for and living for.
Cosby's writing style really carries all this weight, too. It's described as brutal and beautiful.
It really is. It's unflinching in its realism, very visceral, but it never loses sight of the complex emotions underneath. The violence serves the story of their internal turmoil.
And the dialogue feels so real. You can track their whole relationship just by how they talk to each other.
Absolutely. It goes from those really stilted, suspicious, racially charged exchanges at the start.
Yeah, really ugly stuff sometimes.
To, by the end, this genuine, almost protective communication. It's a whole journey in just their conversations.
Which all leads up to the climax. How does it resolve?
Well, it culminates in this huge, spectacular cinematic siege on Gerald's estate. It's the final showdown.
All that rage and grief finally unleashed.
Completely. And they get their revenge. It's bloody, it's costly.
Did they make it?
They survive, just. They're left severely wounded, physically and emotionally, as you'd expect. But something has been purged. That specific guilt, maybe?
And the ending. What's the final feeling?
It's surprisingly hopeful in a very complicated, messy way. You see Ike and Buddy Lee, these two broken men, now united, not just as allies, but as this new, very unconventional family unit.
Committed to raising Ariana together.
Yeah. Their real redemption isn't in the violence they committed, but in that final choice. To dedicate themselves to her, unconditionally.
Wow. So the book really insists that change is possible, even for men seemingly defined by violence and prejudice.
It does. It really challenges you, the reader, to think about your own capacity for conditional love, maybe the unconscious biases we all carry.
And the damage that rejection, even subtle rejection, can do.
Mm-hmm. It's a powerful reminder that real strength isn't about being hard or suppressing pain.
It's about having the courage to face your failures.
Right. Exactly. And it suggests it's maybe never too late to start becoming the person, the parent, you should have been. If you're willing to do the work, pay the price.
A difficult, but ultimately hopeful message.
Deeply felt, certainly. It stays with you.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.